Afternoon. This time we'll call the meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect, it is 1:06 p.m. on Friday, February 3rd, 2012. Let the record reflect, the following members are present: Representative Gardner, Representative Foster, Representative Munoz, Co-Chair Seaton, and myself, Co-Chair Feige. The other Representative Wilson is currently presenting another bill in another committee. She'll be along shortly, as will Representative Dick. We've been joined by Representative Kawasaki and Representative Heron. Okay, the purpose of our meeting today is to hear House Joint Resolution 26, the Sea Otter Management, presented by Representative Peggy Wilson. And time permitting, we will also continue our discussion of House Bill 276, Oil Production Tax Credits on the Nanana Basin by Representative Steve Thompson. Okay, Arthur Martin, who is staff to Representative Wilson, will present. So, Mr. Martin.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, esteemed members of the committee. My name is Arthur Martin, and I'm an intern for Representative Peggy Wilson. I'd like to go on record and just tell her thank you for having me in her office. It really is a pleasure to work for her and an honor. And also, it's an honor to be here in front of this committee presenting on this very important resolution. You should have a CS version in front of you, version B for beta. Now we'll go over what the changes were. The CS change for HGR 26 updated the third whereas clause on page 1 to read, quote, 10,560 sea otters observed in 2003, and a 2010-2011 aerial survey by the United States Fish and Wildlife Service revealed 20,000 sea otters, end quote. And so the previous numbers of 5,800 and 11,000 sea otters, respectively, in the original version. This CS also changed and added an additional line in the third whereas clause, also on page 1, to read, quote, for an approximate annual growth rate of 12% in southern southeast Alaska and 4% in northern southeast Alaska, end quote. So you'd like me to continue?
Go ahead, yeah.
Okay. So HGR 26 will encourage the United States Secretary of the Interior and other appropriate federal agencies to work with Alaska Department of Fish and Game, Southeast Alaska's native leaders, and other interested parties in the state to establish strategies and plans for sustainable long-term management of the reintroduced sea otter populations of Southeast Alaska. HGR 26 will also encourage federal authorities to consider broadening the scope of allowable uses of sea otters taken for subsistence purposes to include the use, transfer, and sale of intact sea otter pelts. So if I may give a brief history of sea otter populations. The sea otter populations almost disappeared completely from the North American continent because of commercial sea otter harvesting during the 18th to 20th century. This led to the species being protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which transferred management of the species from the state of Alaska to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Sea otters were introduced into southeast Alaska from 1965 to 1969 so that the protected mammals would reach, and I quote, an optimal sustainable population range, end quote, after almost being completely wiped out by commercial harvesting. The Fish and Wildlife Service then created a management plan in June of 1994 that was to be, and I quote, reviewed annually and revised at least every 3 to 5 years and modified subject to new findings, changes in species status, policy changes, or congressional direction, end quote. However, our research was not able to locate any revisions since this original plan, which was 18 years ago. So what is happening today? Because of a general harvesting moratorium on sea otters set by the Fish and Wildlife Service, with the exception being Native Alaskans, sea otter populations have rebounded and continue to rise at an estimated 10 to 12% a year, with the last count being approximately 20,000 otters just last year, and in just 3 years, they will reach 28,000. These population increases have become a serious issue of concern to commercial and subsistence fishing because of the competition for resources they create among the local residents due to their voracious appetites. So although sea otters are among the smallest of the marine mammals and perhaps the cutest, They are the largest of the North American weasel family. Male sea otters in Alaska may exceed 100 pounds, and because they have no blubber for warmth, they have to constantly eat, and they can consume up to 23% of their body weight each day of crab, abalone, sea urchins, sea cucumbers, clams, and other shellfish that the human residents rely on for commercial and subsistence uses. That's, again, that's 23% of their body weight that they eat each day. So altogether, these sea otters consume approximately 253,000 pounds of food in a single day. What that really translates to, Mr. Chairman, is a loss of commercial and subsistence fisheries here in Alaska. According to a McDowell report in November of 2011, they estimated that sea otter predation in the Red Sea cucumber, geoduck clam, Red Sea urchin, and Dungeness crab fisheries have cost the Southeast Alaska economy $28.3 million directly and indirectly since 1995. Again, these exponential growths in sea otter populations were directly linked with the demise of the recreational and commercial Dungeness crab fisheries in Orca Inlet and Eastern Prince William Sound. There are also over a dozen fishery harvest areas in Southeast that have closed down or are negatively affected by sea otters. And I can't emphasize enough how problematic sea otters have become in Southeast. Under the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972, Alaska Natives are denied the customary and traditional right to sell intact sea otter pelts to non-natives. With the increase of their reintegrated sea otter populations in Southeast Alaska to the healthy and growing levels, it's time that the native peoples are given back the customary and traditional right. This would not only continue to grow their cultural heritage, but also help maintain an ecological balance while expanding their economic opportunity. Passing this resolution will serve the dual purpose of encouraging a renewed discussion on the possibility of state management in regards to sea otter population, as well as a renewed discussion on the use, transfer, and sale of intact sea otter pelts instead of leaving it to the federal government. This will help Southeast Alaska's municipalities, towns, and villages as they face substantial challenges in developing broader economic opportunities for their residents. We need to encourage the federal government to call for a new management plan now. HGR 26 will send a strong message to federal authorities that a new management structure is desperately needed to manage Southeast otter populations. HGR 26 will also serve as a redress to Native people's customary and traditional right to use, transfer, and sell intact sea otter pelts.
Any questions for Mr. Martin? Or are you done?
Yeah.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Martin? Representative Herron.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Martin, I've looked at the CS and looked at the McDowell report, and this could probably be just a general question for anybody that testifies. Is the first word as is in the late 60s, in the absence of a long-term managed plan, the Department of Fish and Game reintroduced. So what was the thought process in the late 1960s to reintroduce these otters without a plan?
So because of commercial sea otter harvesting, during the 19th, 20th century, the sea otters were almost completely wiped out. They were estimated that, prior to the Russians coming in, there was about, estimated a million sea otters in Alaska, in the North American continent. And they were almost completely wiped out, especially here in Alaska. And so in 1911, there was an international agreement to kind of protect the sea otters and to reestablish them in their traditional regions. And so the plan in the mid to late 60s was to kind of reintroduce them back into the regions and see what happens. And then as they expanded, because the sea otters were put under the protection of the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972, it was transferred from the state to the federal government. So I don't know for a fact if they did or did not have a plan, the state did, but once they were transferred to the federal government, they had the responsibility of overseeing the sea otters, and then it wasn't until 1994 that they actually finally came up with a plan, but the plan wasn't very specific.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Is there a tie to declining herring stocks and sea otter predation? Is there any scientific evidence of a link between herring population and sea otter consumption?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, I honestly don't know the answer to that question, but I think possibly other individuals online or in the room might be able, more qualified to answer that question. Unfortunately, I don't know.
Okay. We do have a bunch of people online, and perhaps after we adopt it for discussion, we'll ask them. Representative Gardner, then Calzaghe.
Thank you. And I don't mind if these questions are answered by other people online. If you don't have the answers, we'll just kind of put them out there. There are a couple of different sort of themes in my questions, a few that I thought of as you were speaking. First of all, can you describe the role of sea otters in kind of a healthy marine ecosystem? And we've talked about how there were a million sea otters before the Russian fur harvest started. And I'm sort of interested in knowing if there were also at that time, if anyone knows, healthy populations of crabs and gooey ducks and abalone and all the mollusks and all of those things that are now being pressured by the sea otter populations, according to this report. So I'm interested in that. And also, you touched on the customary rights and traditions, rights of native populations to, what is it, to use intact sea otter pelts. pelts. Can you kind of explain a little bit about that, about they have some exemptions under current law and how that would change with passage of this bill?
Okay.
Or reaching your goal that passage of this bill would bring.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner. So I'll try to address these questions, and then hopefully somebody else can come after me and perhaps expand on them. But there has been a link with sea otters and kind of benefiting the ecological environment. One of them is a lot of people attribute, you know, sea otter populations to helping out the kelp forests in the sea by eating, like, sea urchins, for example. And sea urchins are kind of predators on the kelp. So sea otters have been known to kind of help out the sea's environment in that regards. But it's come to the point now that sea otters, the population has exponentially grown to such an extreme level that they become really a detriment to the ecological life because they're eating everything. They go into a region, go into an area, and they start just devouring every possible resource, and once that is finished, they move on to a different region. So perhaps in the past there were such, you know, low levels of sea otters that they were beneficial to the kelp forests and things like that, but now they've grown to such level that they're impacting the economy and also hurting the ecological system.
Mr. Chair, if I may. So your testimony has been that there were a million sea otters, and I understand these are kind of estimated numbers, a million sea otters in Alaska prior to the Russians coming in. So do we know if there was a healthy population of the sea life on which they are predators at that time? And do you have an estimate as to the number of sea otters in Alaskan waters now?
So during the 1994 report by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Plan, we kind of talk about a little bit about the, like, sea otter populations and the sea urchin and shellfish life. And they mentioned briefly, along with the McDowell report, that kind of the dive fisheries and the crab fisheries, the animals there weren't very big as they are now, because of a lot of the sea otters. But then when the populations started decreasing and humans came on the scene, there was about like 100 years of growth of these seafood populations, the sea urchins, the geoducks, the sea cucumbers, the crabs, and so they rebounded. And but the McDowell report mentioned that at this point, if the sea otters continue to rise in population, we're not going to be able to, the humans and the sea otters aren't going to be able to, like, coexist together because of just the lack of resources. So the sea otters will completely devour all the commercial and subsistence, you know, fisheries, and then move on, and the commercial and the subsistence communities are going to be out of luck. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, because I still don't know, number one, if there were a million sea otters here years ago.
Oh, okay.
Are we anything close to that now? And were things in balance, as it were, back then? I mean, why would we have maybe fewer sea otters today, but a greater impact on their food species?
So I think the question kind of relates back to the optimal population range, which was discussed in the June 1994 conservation plan for the sea otters in Alaska, and what this optimal, the OSP, which is the optimal sustainable population level, refers to is the number of animals which result in the maximum productivity of the population of the species, keeping in mind the carrying capacity of the habitat and the health of the ecosystem. So I guess they've gone beyond that point, and I'll defer this question to other testifiers on this issue. I apologize if I wasn't able to answer it.
Thank you. I'll still be looking for kind of an understanding of the carrying capacity and the numbers today.
And let the record reflect, I'm joined by Representative Dick.
Yes, thank you. And then the question, I understand there are some exemptions for indigenous populations in this matter, in the matter of pelts and harvesting. So I just like sort of a little more information about that and how that might change.
With this resolution?
If the resolution were to achieve its ultimate goal, what would be the impact on the rights of indigenous people?
So
to use them?
If this resolution was to pass, it would just really hopefully start a discussion along with the appropriate, you know, federal agencies, the state, and the Native Alaskans to come up with a kind of a better management plan and see whether or not they want to kind of expand their ability to sell intact sea otter pelts to non-natives, which would, again, this would go back to the management plan of the sea otter populations. So in effect, I mean, really, this resolution would just start a dialogue more than anything else.
Thank you.
Representative Kelsaki. Thanks for being here, Arthur. I got a question on a couple of the bullet points, the whereases. I guess I'll save the ecological information for Fish and Game. Are they online? Somebody?
Just a couple.
Okay, great. I'll save the questions I've got concerning that. Just it says the whereas on page 2 says the 94 plan is supposed to be revised annually and then revised every three, or reviewed annually, revised every 3 to 5 years. Has that not been happening currently?
As far as I know from the research that I've done, that has not been happening at all. I mean, there's been a lot of different research and stuff done by a lot of different organizations that have included the State Department and the Federal Department, but there has not been a revision to this original plan.
And then, Mr. Chairman, if I might, to go on to the last couple, therefore be it resolves, and what you're actually asking for, it doesn't necessarily say that you're asking for any significant changes to the policy. You're just asking for, I guess, urging the Secretary of Interior, again, to work under the confines of what already seems like a current law under the Conservation Management Plan. So are you actually asking for something different, or are you just simply asking for them to work with us? And
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, as far as I understand it, the purpose of this resolution is really to just re-engage a serious discussion on the sea otter management here in Southeast Alaska with the State Department and the state level. Obviously, you know, us being the state and managing our own resources, we have a little bit better feedback and say as to you know, what we think we should do in regards to our resources. And it seems to be that there is a disconnect there with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service managing the sea otters, because if they're honestly unmanaged at this point because they're growing at such a tremendous rate. So what this resolution is asking is, again, to kind of sit down with the state and the federal government, other interested parties, to discuss, okay, what can we do to resolve this issue?
Okay, so I guess, Mr. Chairman, I guess it's not clear in the further be it resolved or therefore be it resolved. Are we asking that we be basically our own managers exclusively? Because right now they're managed under the 72 MMF or MMP or Marine Mammal Protection Act.
Mm-hmm.
So are we asking that the state of Alaska now become the authority over management of that particular species in those particular waters? Is that what you want to happen?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, no, that is not what this resolution is asking at all. It's not asking for to have the state take over, although that is a possibility. All that this resolution is asking is just to engage in a more serious dialogue on this issue with the appropriate people.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Martin. Do you have anything further to add?
No, sir.
Now, I don't recognize you as one of Representative Wilson's aides. So you're an intern, I understand?
Yes, I am. I'm an intern, first time in this session from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I actually originally moved from the former Soviet Union to Southeast Alaska on Prince of Wales Island in 1997. So it's kind of became reintegrated in America and lost my accent, obviously. But I went to study UAF political science with a minor in Russian. And I'm blessed, honestly, to be down here working for the representative and also seeing how this process works, because it's definitely quite the experience, and it's a lot better than just reading about it in a book.
Nice job.
Thank you. That's what I found out, too. All right, good job, Mr. Martin.
Thank you.
Okay, at this time, I'd entertain a motion to adopt this the committee substitute version B.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Hearing no objection, we'll adopt version B as the working draft for discussion. And at this time, we'll go ahead and open up public testimony on the resolution. We have some folks from the Department of Fish and Game online to answer questions. Vincent Lang is in Anchorage with Fish and Game. And in the room here, Craig Fleener from Fish and Game is also available. So in the room, I've got a couple of people that didn't indicate whether or not they were here for questions or to testify. Tina Brown?
Here to listen.
Listen? Okay. Is it Josh Baker?
I'm here to listen to.
Listen to? All right. And Rosita Worrell?
I'm here to testify.
Testify? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and honorable members of the committee. My name is Rosita Worrell. I am currently the chair of the Alaska Federation of Natives Federal Indian Policy Commission Committee. Julie Kitka had planned to be here. However, the planes didn't allow her to make it in. And so I'm going to offer this a statement on behalf of AFN. But I wear multiple hats. I'm also the vice chair of the Sea Alaska Corporation Board of Directors. And I'm also the president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. And Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, both Sea Alaska and Sea Alaska Heritage Institute have a very direct interest in the sea otter issue. But if I may just talk in general, and then I will speak to the AFN resolution that is directly germane to the resolution. We have been very much aware, we in Alaska and in Southeast Alaska have been aware of the increasing sea otter population and its impact on the resources. And if I could try to answer Representative Gardner's question, I think in the past when there was a million sea otter here, we had only an indigenous population that was using it for traditional purposes. We did not have a commercial fisheries or other kind of commercial enterprises. So we know that right now the population that is here is having an impact on those commercial resources as well as our subsistence resources. We became aware of it through discussions with our villagers. I want to thank Tlingit and Haida Central Council. They have been holding a series of meetings. We had regular audio conference calls with our villages, and we kept hearing from our villagers about the increasing sea otter population and its impact on both commercial fisheries and subsistence fisheries. So we attempted to act to try to see what is it that we could do. The Marine Mammal Act, as it now stands, allows for Alaska Natives to take marine mammals and to use it for customary purposes for subsistence, and also allows them to sell arts and craft, traditional arts and crafts products. And this is where we have an issue, is what is traditional, and if we make a coat, for example, or a teddy bear. I think there was a case actually where a Native person made a teddy bear and there was a citation that it wasn't traditional. And so that's been the question, is what is traditional and what's customary. So we have been trying to advance legislation that, and I will tell you that this is was received with mixed emotions in the community, Native community, because we do have a Native exemption in the Marine Mammal Act. And there was great fear that if we opened it up, that it might change that protection for Alaska Natives. But we felt that the inability to make contemporary items would is causing us problems. We have a number of our people that have been cited. We've complained vigorously about the enforcement practices. We have advanced ideas of co-management. But our idea really was to change the marine mammal law that would allow for the sale of contemporary items. We started a tannery. SDA started a tannery so that we could start tanning marine mammal material and sea otter. At the Alaska Heritage Institute, we started to hold skin sewing workshops, and we were using a model that we had developed in one of our villages, Huna, where we had an extinct, almost our basketry weaving was becoming extinct, and we were able to reintroduce basketry there, and we taught 20 women who are now earning a good income. And so we saw developing skin sewing classes as an opportunity to develop economies in our villages. And so this is where we're coming from, at least from the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute and Sea Alaska. We have started a subsidiary or a corporation at Sea Alaska directed just to dealing with trying to promote village economies. We see sea otters as a possible answer, just one answer to trying to promote sustainable economies in our communities. We have also, insofar as the management issue, I know that the Marine Mammal Commission has been working on this for some time, trying to advance the notion of co-management. There is reference to that in the Marine Mammal Act. It's a long process. I don't know that we're anywhere near it. But in terms of dealing with the problems that we have with the excess, with the surplus, or I don't know if it's surplus or not, but it's certainly having an impact on the environment, on other resources. So we think one of the things that we could do is to really develop this village economies around marine mammal skin sewing classes. And so it's our hope, you know, that that will be part of the answer. We have a proposal. We've met with Fish and Game to talk about our ideas. I think we have a good working relationship there. We also have a proposal to the legislature where we would continue our work in sponsoring skin sewing classes. However, insofar as this resolution itself, we think there are many good things in this resolution, but there is the one whereas that we would find objectionable and oppose, and that would be the sale of pelts. The language is really not clear in specifying who could purchase those the pelts. Right now, it is possible for Natives to sell pelts to other Natives. And if the language in here is to allow for the sale of pelts to non-Natives, then we would oppose that. because of its impact on our village economies. We also know that it would more than likely generate considerable opposition from animal rights groups. And I think we do have at least one letter in, you know, I guess they've heard that we were trying to do something about it and just said they didn't want any changes at all and like things as it is and wanted sea otter population to go on its natural course and expand and then have the collapse, and that would be kind of the natural regulations, and we don't support that. We do support sustainable harvest. So the Alaska Federation of Natives in its last year's convention adopted a resolution, and AFN is the statewide Native organization representing something like 16% of the population of Alaska, or 200 villages, 13 regional corporations, 12 nonprofit corporations, and as I said, over 200 villages. So we adopted a resolution, and I will leave that with you, Mr. Chair, whereby we said that we would oppose any kind of change to the Native exemption in the Marine Mammal Act, and we would oppose the sale of pelts to non-Natives. So, Mr. Chair, that is the position of the AFN, and I will leave you with that resolution. And as I say, insofar as this resolution, the natural resources resolution, we would oppose the sale of pelts if it were meant to be to non-natives because of the two things. We think that we have an opportunity to develop good economies or sustainable economies in our villages. Mr. Chair, that's it.
Yeah, Representative Gardner, question?
Yeah, thank you very much for your testimony. So aside from clarifying whether the sale of pelts is to non-natives, if it were to be to non-natives and there are other elements of this resolution that you do like, overall, would you oppose the whole resolution over that one element?
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative, I think that the resolution is good in its intent, but for that one clause.
Representative Manu.
Thank you, Dr. Worrell. Would you oppose the sale of pelts to non-natives in rural Alaskan small villages?
Yes.
Yes.
We support maintaining the Native exemption, the language as is in the Marine Mammal Act.
Question for me. If a management plan that they come up with requires, say, the taking of 3,000 sea otters or any, you know, a whatever number, do you have the capability, if the sale is limited to essentially, say, limited to Alaska Natives or limited to Southeast Natives?
My understanding, it's limited to Alaska Natives.
Okay, so Alaska Natives anywhere.
I know that you have to live on the coast to be able to be eligible to harvest this sea otter, but you don't. I mean, anyone anywhere can buy. Natives people can purchase sea otter.
Okay, and I think that's what the resolution states. Other than, I don't think it puts a. It doesn't put a limitation on necessarily who you can sell it to. The problem is that if you want to, what I perceive your intent to be is to keep a supply of sea otter pelts that you can then turn into value-added products and have natives turn into value-added products for sale to make a livelihood, correct?
Yes.
Do you have the capacity to utilize all the pelts that would be taken in a management plan? Is it possible that they would, you know, they would ask to have a number this high taken out of the ecosystem, but you can only process this many, which leaves you with a tremendous surplus of pelts? Is that something that you can then store, or how would that work?
I know that we were supposed to have someone here that was planning to testify to that dimension. And that was, you know, we have people at the Sitka Tannery, so STA's tannery, and I think they have expanded their tannery. We also know that there's another tannery developing. We also know that there are tanneries in Anchorage that can accommodate this. We have actually looked at Sea Alaska, whether if there was to be a significant harvest and the tanning were not able to take, the tanneries were not able to process them, would we be able to have the facilities where we might freeze them until such time as we were able to process them. I think that with, first of all, I want to say that, you know, we absolutely support sustainable harvests. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we had an immediate, you know, increase, an immediate increase of, you know, of sea otter harvest, that we would run afoul of people who would like to move to oppose any kind of marketing of it. So we are trying to really work on this in a way that we think will protect Alaska Natives, that will protect Alaska Native communities and the development of this cottage industry.
So that would be something you'd work out in the negotiation of a management plan, sort of a gradual ramp up of a, you know, say a population needs to be taken down, a gradual ramp up of that take to match the increase in capacity for you to utilize the pumps.
It would be a ramp up, but also I think we could also be selective. In our discussions with Fish and Game, we have proposed that if we were able to implement our proposal here, that Fish and Game could identify for us areas where we could target a harvest, and then we would ask our hunters, our Alaska Native hunters in our communities, to target, you know, a particular area. Mm-hmm. So that was how we were looking at it also.
Representative Dick, and then Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm thinking to myself that some of this might be premature. I mean, whatever will support local economy, that's what we want. But the real goal of this is just to start a conversation, and it seems like we're having the tail end of the conversation already. So I think my feeling is that whatever would be most powerful in getting the conversation started, whatever that would be, is maybe the most important thing we should say, because the final conversation is quite a ways down the road.
Right. And I think we've tried that in working at least with the Department of Fish and Game. We've been having ongoing discussions with them and also with the Department of Interior, Department of Agriculture on the problems and how we could begin to address some of the problems, and also with our delegation.
Mm-hmm. Representative Herron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Worrell, good to see you again. People in my area, I think, consider you as a capital E elder. And so we've been focused here on these questions on the pelts, but if we're going to have, at least in the beginning, a huge management plan for the harvest of the animals, what is AFN in your view on the edible parts of the seal?
The edible parts?
The meat, yeah.
Uh-huh. I don't know that we've addressed that. It may be that the Marine Mammal Commission is working on that. We work very closely with the Marine Mammal Commission, and the Marine Mammal Commission has been the entity that has been doing all of the work on this for some 10 years or more. So I don't know. I can't answer that question. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I guess that's, mm-hmm. That's probably should be part of the discussion is there's going to be potentially large quantities of edible meat that we'd have to manage as well.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Right. Thank you.
That's it. But I will ask about that.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions for Dr. Worrell? Representative?
I'll try. I lost my voice. Can you hear? Is your objection, would that be solved by, on page 4, line 1, eliminating, taking out transfer and sale of intact sea otter pelt and inserting in its place for contemporary items?
Yes. I think I must have the old copy, but what our concern is right now is the sale of intact sea otter pelts, and it's not clear whether it's limited to native or non-native.
Good.
That's just where the language.
And a follow-up, Representative Seed.
So if you currently have the ability to sell pelts to natives,
yes,
then we don't need to take care of that, no, for your concern. But you also said that you wanted to make sure that contemporary items were covered.
Right. Yeah, we have been advancing that with our delegation, is to clarify that we can sell contemporary items. Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any more questions? Representative Foster.
Just a comment. Overall, while the goal is to manage the sea otter population, I just wanted to make the comment that I think the impacts on the Alaska Native community in terms of, you know, being able to, you know, reintroduce and encourage cultural practices, the impacts that they can have on the youth, you know, from everything from, you know, even to issues of suicide and so forth, you know, I think this is something that, you know, I'm very much in support of and would encourage those types of things and in terms of just kind of being another goal in terms of what this resolution tries to do. And so I commend you on the work that you're doing. So thank you.
Thank you. I think you've really brought up a very good point, and that is, you know, I just completed a study on the status of Alaska Native women, and of course I had to look at Native men. And one of the things, you know, that we find is that there are just no or very, very limited economic opportunities in the villages, and we know that that's accompanied with a lot of social problems. And, you know, I think people who have good, healthy lifestyles and are able to sustain themselves, you know, can alleviate some of the social problems.
Dr. Worrell, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And next up from Central Council of Tlingit and Haida, Edward Thomas.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and honorable members of the committee. My name is Ed Thomas. I am president of Tlingit and Haida Central Council. First of all, let me start by saying I very much appreciate this resolution and thank Representative Wilson for introducing it. While there are portions of the resolution that need clarity and some that we outright oppose, I think the idea of the state of Alaska and the federal government and the tribes working together to manage a very important resource is a good thing. I happen to be from Craig, Alaska, and happened to be living in Craig when the sea otter was introduced to our region out there, the Morales Island. And back home we call that Hohenwall Islands. But nonetheless, it was kind of a novelty to us when they were introduced because, as pointed out, the management plan was not clear. And was not clear whether they were available for natives or non-natives or anybody. However, as the Marine Mammal Protection Act became refined over time, the harvest of the sea otter became part of the Marine Mammal Protection Act for the Alaska Native utilization. And that is an important component to the act. When we talk about that part of the act, we want to make sure that the purpose of that act is because the indigenous populations relied on those resources from the beginning of time. And it was very important to the policymakers to continue that practice. In this resolution, I believe it does a good job in articulating the resource and the growth of it, as well as the problems that are created with the overpopulation, so I won't be talking a lot about that. When we look at the problem, we need to understand that when the Marine Mammal Protection Act put forth the regulations and the requirements in the Act itself, it was very restrictive on what could be used or what the, excuse me, what the hills could be converted into to be considered part of our tradition, not realizing that today's people are also creating traditions, that what the practice of our people are now are our practices. They're not necessarily all 100% where they were at the contact of the with the Russians, meaning that the point that Dr. World pointed out is that we did not have commercialization of crab or many of the bottom fisheries at that time, and so our natural utilization of those resources was much different. But as time moved forward, we have people that are involved in those fisheries. We have people that utilize them because the ability to gather them have changed. And so then the utilization of the pelts has also changed. And the interaction between our people and other people for the value of those pelts has changed. One of the things that our artisans are worried about is maybe not so much that we would sell a pelt to somebody here in Juneau or in Anchorage or even Seattle. The biggest threat is that if we were allowed to sell those pelts unaltered, you can pretty much guess if you look down here on South Franklin that they would come back as authentic native crafts made in Taiwan. And that's just the nature of the way it works, that if you can find places where people can make them much more efficiently and cheaper and methodologies are much different, then that's where they end up coming from. And so I think it's very important to preserve not just in Alaska rural economy, but our economy as it is. And so that is the primary reason why we at Click and Hide are very concerned about selling pelts without being very clear on how it's going to be utilized. We just don't want to have a mass exit of these resources and then come back for sale in our own region and produced from out of state or even out of the country as far as that goes. So that's a very important concern to us. Now, getting back to the management, I'm one that believes that there could be broadened utilization of the sea otter pelts if there was a loosening up of the words that are being used as traditional or authentic. When you look at a product that is made by a native today and they produce it for tourism and they sell it, that's authentic. Whether it's a totem pole, whether it's a vest, whether it's some other clothing. But when you look at the Marine Mammal Protection Act, they kind of narrow down, well, you got to do it a certain way, and it's got to, you know, have certain conditions to it. Is it something that was made way back when? Now, Rosita mentioned the teddy bear. There is nothing in our society says we never made teddy bears. When I was a youngster, when a person died, they would bury, I mean, they would build a house and they'd put the person's belongings both in the casket as well as in the house. And believe it or not, when if it was a child that died, there would be those products that were either made by the grandma or family members and put into the house where the child was buried. And so that kind of leads back, you know, that a lot of these things that they did not see as we made the transition to our current society, what we're calling contemporary society, a lot of those things may have existed, and there's signs that they did exist prior to contemporary times. And so if there was a loosening up of, and say, let's just use an example. If an artisan was able to use the sea otter pelt to make a vest like this and put a zipper on it, that would be authentic. But it's not according to the the records a traditional thing because it does not meet the criterion. And even a blanket, you know, it goes without saying that our people made blankets out of skin pelts. You don't have to prove it. But if you are trying to abide by the Marine Mammal Protection Act, you'd have to prove it somehow. And since my grandparents really did not use these for blankets, then it's hard for a person like me to prove it. I don't want to ramble. I just want to give some examples of how that I believe that if we were able to do more things with the pelts locally, that there would be more incentive for people to create tanneries. There would be more incentives for people to do something with the byproducts. But with the limited access and the limited utilization, we're stuck with this problem. And that is where I believe this committee, working with the scientific community, can do some good in helping us work through the maze of federal regulations so that, in fact, we can make better utilization of those resources locally and still control the population so that it makes sense to all utilization. I mean, all people that utilize the resources that are being consumed by the sea otter. I'm going to close my comments now and see if Carrie Sykes has any comments to add. Carrie is our Business and Economic Development Director, but she is charged with dealing with the subsistence aspects of our region and has been working with the Sea Otter Commission as well as our own Alaska Native Sea Otter Commission.
And before you get started, just like to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Sista in the back row.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Carrie Sykes. I work for Tlingit Iyot Central Council. And in addition to my position there, I also am a sea otter sower. So I've been sowing sea otters since about 1990. So I'm very familiar with what is involved with the processes. In my position this last year, we had a workshop with the Southeast Tribes. It was held in Sitka at the end of March. And we had a number of Southeast Tribes present. I think there were approximately 12 different communities represented at that meeting. But we found in that meeting, where Fish and Wildlife was included, they sponsored it, that there was a need for a lot of information and education. The tribes were not clear about what the Marine Mammal Protection Act allowed for them. They were fearful of harvesting because of enforcement issues that had happened in the past to other tribal members. So there was quite a bit of discussion, and it brought up a lot of issues. I think the biggest issue is that there needs to be a government-to-government consultation between the Fish and Wildlife and the local tribes so that they can work on management in their local areas. It's really important to the tribes that they have that kind of input on what's happening in their region. That actually got started in 2011, but there was a change in position at Fish and Wildlife. Doug Byrne, who had been working on that effort, changed jobs, and so we recently had a meeting and we urged the Fish and Wildlife Service to fill that position. This was during an economic development workshop that was held in December. So I think that is an ongoing effort, but they're looking at restarting that government-to-government consultation. In addition to that, there were a lot of enforcement issues. Like I mentioned before, the tribal members were fearful about going out and harvesting without some clear definitions about what is significantly altered. But just recently, there was a letter that came out from Fish and Wildlife where they drafted some language about significantly altered. And so we're very happy to see that there's been an effort to start to define that in the regulation so that people have a clear understanding of what is allowable and what is not allowable. And then again, what is authentic? You know, it is our position that if it's made by a native, that it is authentic. And in addition to that, if you killed and tanned a hide, we consider that it's significantly altered. And that is one thing that I've heard repeatedly. So just some side notes there. Yeah, but in any case, there's a lot of need for education and outreach. I think that, particularly when you hear comments from, like, defenders of the wildlife that are opposing any, harm to sea otters, that they don't understand the impacts to the shellfish and to our subsistence foods. So I think there needs to be a lot of education and outreach and, just letting more people know about what the real situation is and what is allowed by the Marine Mammal Protection Act. In addition to that, there is opportunity for economic development. But there's lots of needs. For instance, there needs to be training for how to sew the skins, and that has been started to a certain extent. There needs to be training about how to skin the hides, and also, some efforts in more facilities for tanning and opportunities for marketing, and, even opportunities for coordinating with other sea otter sewers. For instance, I don't go out and hunt sea otter. I doubt that I ever will, but, I'd like to just do it a barter with a hunter. So there's a need for a lot of collaboration and training and education and outreach, and that's what I found in dealing with the Southeast tribes. Oh, and one more note. The question did come up about whether or not the meat was edible, and I heard from the hunters that it's not, that it's really horrible. So and it was a hunter from Angoon, and he said that they cooked it and tried to offer it to the fish and wildlife people, and they wouldn't eat it. And I don't have first-hand experience, but I just wanted to offer that. And also about the customary traditional use, I want to mention that it is documented that over 200 years ago that the sea otters were used in the raven's tail weaving. And those blankets or those robes are in Russia and other places around the world. So it has been documented in some cases that, there was extensive use of those traditionally.
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. I'm sure the tastiness of sea otter meat may depend on how hungry you are, too. Any questions for our folks from the Tlingit Haida Central Council? Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under the Marine Mammal Act, is the burden of proof on the Alaska Native to prove that something is traditional and customary, for example, the teddy bear, or is the burden of proof on Fish and Wildlife to say that something is not traditional and customary? How does that?
There is very little burden of proof. They kind of utilize the traditional from their own perception. And that's what creates the problem. As Kerry was talking, that creates a very nervous person because the fines are not very light. They're pretty extensive fines for violating the act. And so when you have a regulator or a person in high position that interprets something different than what you are, then you get in trouble. It's not one whereby, I disagree with you, so we'll agree to disagree. I'll go my way, you go your way. That's not the way it works. They set their criteria. Now, to the benefit of the the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service, they are coming down with a proposed definition of what significantly altered means. The problem is that it's a little light for a person like me. I believe that if they look at the issue of authentic, whether something is authentic or not, is more important than whether they understand what significantly altered means to them. And I think it sounds like splitting hairs, but it isn't. But I go back that if we define it properly, I think it'll have a much better chance of allowing people to utilize the resource better.
Just to follow up, I just wanted to make sure that you weren't being required to provide a picture from 200 years ago that says we were, making traditional. And maybe, I don't know if Fish and Game will be also testifying, or Fish and Wildlife, I mean.
We don't have anyone from Fish and Wildlife.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions?
There is some truth to what you're saying, though. If it does from their perspective, if it isn't in a museum somewhere or they haven't seen it, then it's probably not a traditional use.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. As Fish and Wildlife, the Fish and Wildlife Service defines what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, how were the individuals that you mentioned dealt with? I mean, what was the resolution of those cases where there was a misagreement over whether it was traditional or not?
Well, I know that in the past that it's been left up to the Fish and Wildlife Service. And so that is something that, like I said, it makes everyone fearful. But with this new definition that has come out, they have sent out a letter to request tribal consultation and input on their definition. And that letter just came out a couple weeks ago, and I think we have until the end of March to comment on that definition.
Okay. So just as a follow-up, the artists, though, that were cited, are they continuing, or did they pay the fine and, they're trying to comply?
I know artists from Ketchikan who have had their hides seized, and they've had them seized for 3 years, and they're still waiting. And one example was they didn't have their paperwork for the tags. They were tagged correctly, but they did not have their paperwork from, I think it was 15 years before, and so they grabbed those hides. And the Fish and Wildlife Service did not have their own paperwork. But they still took those hides, and to my knowledge, I spoke with this lady at AFN just a couple months ago, and she still has not received those hides. And another one was a young man who's getting ready to go to prison, and he didn't keep up on his paperwork. But his claim is that, that they tricked him. He sold to a non-native. And I heard this at my workshop, was that, are you supposed to request proof if you're going to sell a hide, if you think someone's native or not? And so there again is the burden of proof. And so it's just really unclear. That's been the problem.
Okay. And just one final question.
Follow-up.
If I may. Are the citations happening from local Fish and Wildlife Service employees, or are they folks that are coming in from the agency?
It's my understanding that there's two arms of the Fish and Wildlife Service. There's a management arm that's out of Anchorage, and the enforcement people are in Washington, D.C., but I think they get cited from the local officers, but it's actually handled through Washington, D.C., because that was one of the big questions at our workshop was, you want us to harvest, but you're enforcing us, and that doesn't mean, forcing and citing people, and that doesn't make it, people wanting to run out and go harvest. So it was in conflict with their own agency, that one side is wanting management and wanting natives to harvest, and the other is citing people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Dick.
This makes a point that I tried to make last year. I've resolved the wood bison issue in other ways, but this is exactly the point I was trying to make last year. Here we have subsistence people that are trying to live subsistence, and they find themselves litigants, and they're two totally contradictory lifestyles. So you want to live subsistence, but in order to do that, you have to end up behind a microphone and testimony and everything else. We need to free the folks up so they can just live off the land the way they have for a long time. Up there. But this is exactly the point I was making last year, that I didn't want to happen to the people in the Grayling, Anvik-Chagalik, and Holy Cross. They end up in meetings like this.
Okay, any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity.
Live off the sea in this case.
And I believe the final person to testify in the room is Kirk Hardcastle. And you listed yourself as a commercial fisherman?
Correct. Hello, my name is Kirk Hardcastle. I'm a commercial fisherman here in Southeast Alaska, and I like to kill fish. So I'll keep it kind of short and simple, since all of our time is very valuable. I've said this many times before in other times I've testified in regards to fisheries and resources, is that commercial fishing is the stabilizing economic influence for the entire state of Alaska. It is not oil, it is not timber, it is not mining, it is not tourism. It is commercial fishing. Commercial fishing is very essential for this state of Alaska. oh gosh, I got a whole list of notes I'd like to talk about. But I guess more importantly is to really emphasize that what the sea otter is for Southeast Alaska. Whether you like them because they're cute or you want to harvest them for one reason or the other, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a businessman. I like to make money when I can. And understanding the role that the sea otter has in all of the fisheries in Southeast Alaska is absolutely essential. I studied marine biology and environmental physiology in college, and so I was born and raised around sea otters. And what the sea otter is what's called a keystone species. For those of you who don't know what a keystone is, it's something that holds a whole arc together. Whether you like seals or sea lions, they are not keystone species. Commercial fishing is a keystone economic influence for the state of Alaska. Now, the sea otter, to what it does for the kelp forest, is that it eats, as you can see in the reports here, majority of its diet is on sea urchins and abalones. Now, sea urchins and abalones are little grazers. They're like little miniature cows. When the kelp starts to grow on the rocks, those shellfish will actually eat the kelp. So what happens is the sea otters keep that in check, okay? So what they do is they keep the urchins and all the grazers in check so that we have a kelp forest. So what about kelp? Who cares about kelp? I don't care about kelp because I fish on the inside. We don't have kelp on the inside. What kelp does, it provides the rearing grounds for all of our fisheries, our crab, our shellfish, our salmon, our halibut, our crab, our cod. All those juvenile species have to live in the kelp forest before they go to the outer waters, okay? As a small, tiny juvenile fish, you don't have protection from larger predators. The kelp forest is an entanglement of a net. Large predators cannot get in there. This is where our small species, once the salmon leave the inland water systems and migrate to the outer open ocean waters, they hide and live within those kelp forests. The crab have several different morphic stages. For those of you who don't know what a morphic stage is, it's very similar to a caterpillar to a butterfly. That's two morphic stages. Dungeness crab, for instance, have about 13 different styles of morphic stages. And each one of those morphic stages can either live in the mud, in the rocks, can move out to the open ocean, drift back in, but they all, at one stage in their life, live in these kelp forests. Whether you like the otters or not, cute economic value, their major economic value is that they provide rearing grounds for all of our industries, our economic stabilizing influence for the entire state of Alaska, especially in Southeast Alaska, really hangs in the balance on the productivity that the sea otters can make sure that we have a kelp forest for them to live in, okay? That's the primary part for me. Otters are cute, as cute as they are, as mean as they are. I've been bit by them several times. They're nasty little buggers. But as far as what, pardon me for that one. Basically, to cut it to short, is that one thing that a lot of these economic impacts from the McDowell Report emphasize are, what are the impacts of the predation? Well, one thing that nobody has been looking at is, what are the economic impacts of sea otters if their numbers do rise? We do know more kelp means more rearing grounds. More rearing grounds means more availability for any juvenile species of fish, cod, halibut, crab, goey duck, clams, salmon, to be able to make it to the outer ocean and come back and increase all of our pocketbooks. Southeast Alaska, especially on the inside here, we know that we don't have a whole lot of otters. They're mostly out on the outside here. But we are a fishing community here, although we do have the capital and the feds, which is nice. But we're a fishing community throughout Southeast Alaska. We all rely on subsistence and commercial value for all of these species. The more kelp you have, the more fish you have. And no one has done a report on the benefits of having otters and greater kelp forests. In Southeast Alaska, I haven't seen any reports on that. In Northern California, where the sea otter population has come back, they have seen a rebound in all of those species as well. It's kind of not really protected areas, but they've noticed that all the other species start to rebound because they have a protected area to hide in. Okay. In regards to Representative Wilson's intern, the quotes devour every resource and hurt the ecological system, there are numerous papers to show that that is false. Hurt the ecological system, do nothing but benefit. Okay, devour every resource. There's a pie graph on both McDowell's report as well as the memorandum in here that shows that they do not devour every resource. They primarily, only 7% of their diet is compromised of what these shell fisheries want to endorse for the harvest of these sea otters. 7% of their diet. Majority of their diet is a non-commercial valuable that's 7% on the high side. It's even down to 5%. So 95% of the sea otter diet has nothing to do with commercial harvested animals in the area. I just want to go back to again. I'm a commercial fisherman. I'm also on the advisory committee for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and I've been involved with the sea otter issue for quite some time. Not only the fact that I grew up with these otters, too. And to tap off on the last one, it's a federal species. It's not a state species. The tourism value for these animals alone, people love these cute little creatures. I don't really need to be around them. I've been around them enough, but I do understand the economic value throughout Southeast Alaska in the tourism industry for these creatures is much greater alive than it is dead. And then the unintended consequences of keeping these guys alive or dead, no one's really done any papers on this. They just see the direct impacts of these guys are killing my crab, they're killing my salmon. Has anybody ever thought about that there happens to be more crab for people to actually go out and get more fish? No one's done any studies for this. So as a commercial fisherman, I do just want to emphasize how important it is in Southeast Alaska primarily that we do have large abundance of sea otter populations only for the reason that we have healthy kelp forest systems for all of our fisheries, the crab, the halibut, the cod, every other kind of fishery that we have needs to rear in those kelp forests before they migrate to the outer waters. Thank you for your time.
Questions for Mr. Hardcastle. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. So what is the other 95% of the sea otter's diet?
That is in, let's see, it was in, I believe it's mostly clams. And in Southeast Alaska, you know, we really don't, actually Representative Munoz knows that we don't eat clams all that much except for certain times of the year. Let's see, I believe it's in the McDowell report. And let me get my glasses on. Let's see, if it's a pie chart.
Actually, in the...
There we go. Yeah, majority of it is, you know, the red urchins, the gooey duck, shrimp. This is a different one that I was looking at in this report. It wasn't in this. I apologize.
That's okay. I'll find it now. I know where to look for it.
Yes, here it is. Here it is. Thank you very much. As you can see, I don't know, this isn't listed anywhere, but almost 52% is clams, other echinoderms, mollusks, fish, scallops, sand lance, gooey duck, shrimp, tanner crab, red urchins, and I'm going to ignore the dungies and the cucumbers, and then it goes to barnacles, unidentified prey, and non-commercial crabs make up almost 95% of their diet. So 95% of their diet is non-commercially viable for the economic influence of our state, specifically for Southeast Alaska. We're talking about merely 5% of their diet that they're looking at. To eliminate that 5% will impact 100% of our fisheries in Southeast Alaska. 100% of the fisheries will be impacted by the decline of the sea otter population, strictly because we need to have those kelp forests not impacted. Okay, we want to have healthy kelp forests, and we don't have those on the inside. They're primarily on the outside. Sea otters aren't moving to the inside. They don't live where there's no kelp. Sea otters don't float very well. They don't have blubber. They have thick fur, and they need to wrap themselves in kelp to be able to keep afloat. So the benefits of having a higher sea otter population could really benefit all the fisheries in the long run. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Munoz, then Wilson.
Thank you. Kurt, could you tell me what the state of the kelp forest is today and if there's any tie-in with the sea otter and the increase in sea otter population and growth in kelp forest today or not? Or where, you know, have we seen any changes?
I didn't study the kelp forest primarily in Southeast Alaska most recently because I've been involved in fisheries. As far as following that, in marine biology, it's common knowledge. There's an abundance of information. I don't have that specific information, but it can be found somewhere. We just know that the diet of the otters is really primarily is the urchins and the abalones. And if we do eliminate the otters, we are going to have an abundant urchin fishery to be able to maintain the growth of the forest. So if we do remove these sea otters, we should really, really seriously encourage a massive, massive urchin industry just so that we can have the kelp forest. And an urchin industry at that size and scale, it would have to come from Asia, and that would be importing labor rather than having locals do it.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
I'm looking at the McDowell report. On page 8, the last paragraph, and I think this is what we're more concerned about than anything else. It says, other studies tend to support the notion that sea otters are opportunistic generalists which adapt their predation to their environment. And many studies have found that as they don't have a tendency, the otters themselves, and by the way, I live in Wrangell, mm-hmm. and we have them right in our harbor. Mm-hmm. So I know that they're living in our harbor, and my house is in the harbor, and I see them all the time. What happens is it's not like some species where they eat until they get done with, and they've eaten all what they normally eat. And so if it's not there, then they move on to somewhere else and eat there until it's gone, and then they go somewhere else. Sea otters don't do that. They are very adaptable, and so in their eating, if they eat and one species is gone that was their favorite maybe, well, then they'll go to their second favorite because they have to be eating constantly. And so that just – they will go until that they just really go down to not very much is left, and they don't move on until that happens. And in the meantime, we're seeing that there are industries, maybe not the commercial fisheries industry, because they might be out a little bit further, but for the industries that we're talking about, these industries are affected now, and we're seeing a big difference now in these areas. So I think that I'm not saying that we're not trying to get rid of them by any means. I don't think it would be possible at this point in time to get rid of them, but we're saying that we're hoping that the natives can do what they traditionally have done for years, and that they can be able to harvest them, use their skins to make other things so that they can make money. And that's what we're saying, nothing more than that. And if we just keep it to them, we're not going to over-harvest by any means of the imagination. So that's my comment.
I think the point of the resolution is that we're advocating for a management plan of some kind, not necessarily complete extermination of the right. of the species. So,
correct.
Any other questions from committee? Thank you, Mr. Hardcastle. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay. At this point, we're starting to run a little long, so we have several folks that are at either LIOs or off-net. Yes. And for those folks that are listening, if you could please keep your comments brief. I'm sure you're aware of the issue, the points that have already been brought up by the previous testifiers. So if you've got something new, please bring it up. If it's already been addressed, perhaps you can to let it go. So first one up, I'll start in Ketchikan with Phil Doherty from the Southeast Alaska Dive Association.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Resource Committee. Thank you for your time today. And as you pointed out, this has run long, and I'll try and keep my comments as short as possible, although a lot of testimony has been given today, and especially with Mr. Hardcastle, just, you know, I'd have to disagree with so many things that he said as it pertains to Southeast Alaska that I'm not sure where to start. So on February 1st, I sent the committee a letter, and I won't go over that letter due to the time. And also, you have the McDowell Group study in front of you right now. Our point of view of the Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fisheries Association is that when there are sea otters with an increasing population, such as U.S. Fish and Wildlife has shown, that we have lost millions and millions of dollars worth of harvest potential. There's very little doubt that where there are sea otters, there are no sea urchins, there are no gooey duck clams, there are no sea cucumbers. Those are the first species to go. When you look at their diet chart, and the big problem that we have with this, the one that has just been finished, it shows that 38% of their diet is sea urchins. That's a harvestable species under the SAFTA. 10% of their harvest, 10% of their diet is gooey ducks, and 4% is sea cucumbers. The problem with that study is that this study was done in areas where sea otters were had already inhabited for many, many years, so the sea cucumbers were basically gone, as were the sea urchins. I think if what the University of Alaska study is showing, that as they move into new areas and they expand their range, that the first things that go are urchins and sea cucumbers and gooey ducks, and then they'll start to eat more undesirable food sources like hardshell clams. So they impact our fisheries. We've had 14 areas closed down to sea cucumber fishery because of sea otter predation, as so stated by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We've had our gooey duck clam guideline harvest levels cut by hundreds of thousands of pounds. Next year we're going to lose another 150,000 pounds of guideline harvest level. And gooey duck clams, yesterday's opening, we're getting $22 a pound. And that is stated by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And during their latest assessment work on red sea urchins, they found that there was 5 million pounds less sea urchins in southeast Alaska than there was just a handful of years ago. That's Alaska Department of Fish and Game's numbers, not mine. And they attributed directly to sea otter predation. We realize that the resolution that would encourage and increase the harvest of sea otters as an economic benefit to the southeast native community probably isn't going to do enough to really affect the impacts on our commercial fishing. However, it is a step in the right direction, and my association fully supports Representative Wilson's resolution here. Over the past 2 or 3 years, the city of Ketchikan, the borough of Ketchikan, the city of Petersburg, the Prince of Wales Economic Impact Group, the town of Cake, the Petersburg Vessels Owners Association, the Southeast Alaska Fishermen's Association, SARFTA, the United Fishermen's Association, the Southeast Regional Advisory Committee, and the Tlingit-Haida Central Council have all written resolutions saying that sea otters in southeast Alaska should be managed. So Representative Wilson does not stand alone on this. There's every town and every group imaginable in southeast Alaska wants something done about sea otters. In the last 3 years, I've met with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service numerous times. I've been in numerous meetings with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I've met with the Tlingit-Haida Council. I've met with the United Fishermen's Association. I was at the Board of Fish last week in Petersburg talking about sea otters and the sea otter problem. I've met and I chair a group in the Juneau Economic Development Committee talking about sea otters. All of these groups understand and realize the impact sea otters are having in southeast Alaska. From the economic point of view, from the commercial fishing, for all the dive species and for Dungeness crab, and also the impact it's having on the subsistence fishery. So, in closing, we ask this committee to support Representative Wilson's resolution. We also ask you to encourage the state of Alaska through the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the Parnell Administration, to keep the pressure on U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in terms of the Marine Mammal Protection Act and coming up with a feasible management plan for sea otters in southeast Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Doherty. Questions for Mr. Doherty from the committee? Okay, thank you, Mr. Doherty. Appreciate your testimony. Next, I'd like to go to, on the off-net, the mayor of Craig, Dennis Watson. Mr. Watson, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. Go ahead.
Okay, good. I also take great exception to Mr. Hardcastle's comments, for the record. Okay, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Dennis Watson. I'm the mayor of the city of Craig on Prince of Wales Island in the southeast part of the state. I am testifying today in support of HJR 26. I'm a 38-year resident of Craig and have been a commercial fisherman since my arrival. For 16 of those years, up until last year, I spent my fall months working at a commercial dive fishing operation harvesting sea cucumbers. For the first 15 years I spent in this area, sea cucumbers were a rare sight, and as Edward Thomas mentioned earlier, we're all quite amused by them. By the mid-80s, large numbers of otters became common sight around southern southeast. Now it is a rare occasion that you can find a place here where you don't see an otter. And I'm talking about offshore, you know, and I'm a troller, you know. Sometimes I'm fishing 20 miles offshore, and the doggone things are way out there. So it's been my experience in the dive fishery, and over the years, I probably have close to 1,000 hours watching the bottom of the ocean through via underwater camera while we're surveying for cucumbers, and I've got a real good chance to really take in what's happened with these otters. In the beginning, once again, it was really amusing to watch them. They're quite efficient, really smart little creatures. But after a while, we begin to realize that how they get into an area and quickly just devastate the species in that area, and then they move on. You know, their feeding cycle, you know, it's been, once again, my experience, begins with the easy access shellfish and sea urchins in the intertidal areas. When these species are depleted, they move on to deeper water where they work on horse clams, geoducks, sea cucumbers, and crabs until just about all the edible species are gone. And in the end, they eat the starfish. I guess that must be the end of the road thing, because when they're ready to move on to another area, you see lots of them up there chewing on starfish. What's left when the sea otters move out, and this is once again what I see looking at the bottom, and time and time again in the same places over and over again, they dig big, deep holes in the bottom while they're chasing after clams and other species down there. And when they're left, that's all there is there. You don't see any starfish. You don't see any urchins. You don't see anything left when they go. I mean, these species are just, they harvest and go, and they don't leave anything behind them. Now, as has been mentioned, many of these species are important to subsistence users and to commercial harvesters. And I can tell you that in this area, the dive fishery, I believe in this year, I heard that it's projected to have around a $20 million accessible value in Southeast by the end of the season. You know, that's huge. And these small villages, you know, where there's virtually no economy in the fall and winter months. And in Craig alone, and last year, there was a $10 million payroll in this town because of the geoduck harvest. I mean, that is absolutely huge. And that's not even including the processors and the shippers and all the support services that go along with it. This is a big economy for us in a time of the year when there's just nothing to do. So we get down to the end where sea otters have, you know, they have propagated here, you know, and they don't really have any predators around here that take very many of them. So to keep their numbers in balance, sorry, I just had an interruption there. To keep their numbers in balance with the rest of the ecology of the region, I think we need to do something about it. You know, man has had a hand in depleting these species in the beginning. And by the way, from the numbers I've heard from Fish and Wildlife Service, they don't really know how many were in Southeast. We could have way more here now than we ever had at any point in history. You know, that nobody really knows that right now, that I could tell anyway. But anyway, we've had a hand in depleting them, and we've had a hand in bringing them back, and I believe that man needs to move in and manage these creatures. Another question that was asked earlier, they were put in here without any rational management plan. As I understand it from a guy who did his PhD dissertation on this subject, that the otters were reintroduced in this area to recreate the commercial harvest of otters. The management plan was going to be to trap them. Well, the Marine Mammals Act cut that short. So, you know, I hope that we can do something with this resolution. I hope that our native friends can be allowed to take more of these creatures with less of a problem. I mean, I can tell you there's some people around here who got into real hot water over what we thought were some very, very minor violation. So we'd like to see that get cleaned up. We'd like to see a better management plan. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Watson, or Mayor Watson. Any questions from the committee? Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Just briefly, I keep forgetting to ask this of some other people, but aside from man, what would be a natural predator of a sea otter?
Well, as I'm hearing it from up north, it sounds to me like their killer whales up there really like sea otters, but unfortunately ours are fish eaters, and maybe we need to retrain them or something.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Mayor Watson. Appreciate your comments. We've got time for one more individual, and since we're in Craig, James Anderson, are you still there? Yeah, Mr. Anderson, if you would state your name for the record and proceed, please keep it relatively brief.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Mr. Anderson.
Jim, we can hear you. You can hear me. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is James Anderson. I live in Craig. You know, and I pretty much agree with, you know, pretty much what everybody's been saying. You know, and for one thing, too, is the sea otter, they eat so much shellfish, you know, that they're really rich, and they are not edible. I don't care how you cook them. You know, I mean, the native people, we've never ate them, you know. You might do some studies on seeing what could be made with some dog food, you know, but other than that, I mean, you're going to have some waste in order to save what you want, you know, and the dive fisheries that are going on, we're not going to have a dive fisher if we let the sea otter, you know, continue as they are. You know, and, it, you know, it's never been said, but when you see a whole herd of these sea otter coming into an area, I mean, we're talking a couple hundred at a time. It's just a big old bed in the ocean. You know, and like Watson was saying, is that once they are done, there is nothing left on the bottom. I mean, a starfish can't survive. You know, and for anything to reproduce, it's not going to happen. And as far as the what we can and cannot do with these sea otters, you know, it boils down to entrapment. You know, one of the guys in Craig that I worked with, he was more or less was entrapped. He was enticed to sell hides to an undercover guy. You know, so you're not looking at a fish and game guy with a badge. You're looking at somebody that's sitting right next to you trying to talk you into selling them a hide. And then when you sell them one, then it's all right, I got you. You know, I'm doing my job, you know. That's not right. You know, and years ago, you know, we started out killing things with a stick. As time started progressing, well, we put a rock on the end of the stick. You know, you get an arrow, you get a spear. You know, so as traditional, you know, native lives are always changing. And so our methods of the way we do things, you know, what we make, you know, like a teddy bear, for instance. Well, maybe a native teddy bear didn't look like somebody else's teddy bear, but still to us it's a teddy bear. So, you know, so our lives are changing all the time. The way our artwork, all our stuff is always changing. And, you know, that's something that, you know, has got to be considered. And as far as, you know, what we can do, I think we need to lighten up the restrictions for the natives so that they can work with the sea otters. Any one of you that are sitting on that committee, try to figure out what you could do. Once you go out and shoot a sea otter, try to figure out how you can legally get that from a skin to a product to sell without getting in trouble. You know, you almost have to have a college degree for that. And we have a problem with sea otter, and it needs to be addressed. I myself would like to start a tannery right there in Craig, Port St. Nick, right where I live. But I'm just having problems finding somewhere, you know, grants, you know. I mean, I could put a lot of people to work. If it's got to be native, well, so be it, you know. I could put native families to work on Prince of Wales. You know, we've got a lot of sea otter there, and if you manage it right, you know, you could have a industry that'll last a long time. You know, we've got native tribes, corporations and stuff, but then again, I would kind of leave it to the individual myself, because I mean, you can see as far as the timber and stuff has gone, your normal native has not gotten very far. You know, it's kind of who's who in the pecking order. But I would study it a lot more and see what we can do to lighten it up for people to utilize the resource. Yeah, I don't know if you can hear me anymore or not, but I'm kind of standing outside so I can hear you. But anyway, that's pretty much what I got to say. And if there's any way I could say more, well, I'll talk to Martin, and he's got my number and stuff. So, I'd like to hear from you. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Anderson. Questions from the committee for Mr. Anderson? Representative Dick.
I just want to agree with you, sir. It's an important point that the people have an image of Native culture having been fixed in time, as if we have a snapshot. And what we've really had throughout millennia is a movie. It's always been ongoing. And the idea that you can take a picture at 1880 and that's how it was is a really flawed concept. So I thank you for making that point clearer for us. It's a misconception a lot of people entertain.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Anderson, for your testimony. To the folks in Petersburg and Sitka, I apologize. We're kind of running out of time here. We are going to set House Joint Resolution 26 aside and pick it up probably next week. So we will let public testimony remain open, and we will give you the folks in Petersburg and Sitka the opportunity to speak on the issue. At this
time. Yeah, one more thing, if I may.
Go ahead, Mr.
I'd like to see our dietitian continue on. You know, and, our community does need it. But years ago, as a teenager, when I'd fish halibut or hand trolls from a boat, we used to be able to walk on the beach and pick up abalones. And I haven't had an abalone in over 20 years. You know, because now we've got not only the sea otters coming after them, we've also got the divers. But if we manage things right, you know, we can all have some of it. You know, I wouldn't want to see the sea otter decimated either. I'd like to go out and manage the herd. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Anderson. All right, at this time, we've got Bill Barron, the director of Division of Oil and Gas, kind of continuing our conversation on House Bill 276 and other of those issues. And Mr. Barron will be heading back to Anchorage here, hopefully, this evening.
You might want to make plans.
Only time will tell.
We'll see. Mr. Behrens was in on a discussion that we had with both myself and the co-chair and staffs regarding some of the issues around sort of the oil and gas exploration credits and various incentives that we wanted to kind of go over with it as it's associated with House Bill 276. And maybe the best thing to do, Mr. Behrens, is just kind of open it up to you. And we have a proposal really to basically put forward some Cook Inlet style credits by incentivizing the first, second, and third exploration drill holes drilled into the Nanana Basin, but at the same time we're talking about what other exploration incentives should we consider, maybe not necessarily with just one basin, but perhaps a template that we can use in all the basins through the state. So at this point I'll just open it up to you, and kind of like we did last meeting, if we have questions as we go along, committee members should feel free to ask away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Bill Barron, and I'm the Director of the Division of Oil and Gas for the State of Alaska. Where to start? Incentives for exploration in remote areas is probably something that needs to be considered very strongly. There are only a handful of areas in the state that have currently had much of any exploration, and even fewer that have had development. The Nanana Basin is one of them that has been the subject of the subject du jour, as we would kind of like to say. But I think that part of what needs to be explained to that was had part of the dialogue we had on the phone was the entire process of exploration licenses, leases, and units. And if that's the direction the chair would like to go, I would be happy to explain the current process.
You know, if you could do that, just to give background to the rest of the committee, I think that'd be educational for all concerned.
Sure. My pleasure. For the areas of the state that and state lands that are not part of the existing area-wide lease sale program, We have an opportunity to establish exploration licenses. And what that entails is if party or parties come to the state and want to do exploration in a certain area, they can apply, they can nominate the land and the area for that license. What the state would then do is we would start our process, which takes about 2 years, to conduct a best interest finding for that area. And upon completion of that best interest finding, or BIF, the state would open that area up for a competitive bid process for its exploration license term. Now, the license is granted not based on a work commitment. The license is based on a dollar commitment. The term of the lease, or the license, excuse me, is typically 10 years. And during that time frame, the company that is awarded, or the parties that are awarded the license, are required to expend 25% of their commitment within the first 4 years, and then they have the remaining term to spend the rest of their money. At the end of the license term, the land or any portion of the land that was already part of the license can be extended into a lease. At that time, the state would then gain $3 per acre lease fees for the designated area. And the term of the lease is negotiated between the two parties, the state and the party, between 5 and 10 years. Typically, it's 10 years. During that time frame, this is where it gets to be very typical with the area-wide lease sale, is the parties are encouraged to do additional exploration work, driving the property closer and closer toward development and production. Upon, let's assume a failure leg, either at the license period or the lease period. If there's a failure leg, failure being they don't see anything or find anything worth continuing the work, on the license side, the property is just returned to the state. On the lease side, if they don't do any work, the property is returned to the state after the lease period. In a success leg, if someone has the advantage and drills the discovery well, improves hydrocarbon, improves closure, in conjunction with the DNR folks, a unit is formed. Once a unit is formed, that then secures the land for an additional term, typically of 5 years, unless the property is developed and producing, then it's on until the property no longer produces hydrocarbon. So that is the typical process to go from a license to a lease to a unit. The reason why I want to make that distinction is there are very definite time frames, processes, and procedures that we follow in the state for everyone's protection in terms of property, the land, and the research development. That's part of the discussion we had on the phone the other day, just for background information. In terms of the proposed language that I have seen as of today, part of what I think needs to take place is that the credits need to be for state lands, and I think they probably need to be for native lands as well. Federal property is kind of a whole different issue. I also fully maintain that properties for this type of tax credit should be lands that are excluded or exclude the lands that are currently in the area-wide lease sale. There's already a very robust process, credits, tax programs, etc. for those areas. And those areas are already, you know, perspective in their own regard. The intent, I understand, of this bill is to encourage exploration activities in areas that have never really been explored before. So, lands that are currently in the existing lease sales are probably not in that area that would be of interest for this tax credit.
In addition to native corporation lands being included on top of state lands, how should we handle mental health trust as well as private mineral holdings?
I'd have to give that some more thought. In concept, they could be rolled in the same time, the same manner as dealing with those. Now, there is some subtleties relative to native land. Is at this juncture, there would have to be some very clear definition of the acquisition of information and data and sharing that data, either to the state or publicly. Right now, that is not the typical format for native land exploration. That information is typically not made public. So if the intent is to encourage exploration, and if the intent is for the state to gain data and then share that data with other parties that might be interested in that area, that would have to be adjusted in some manner.
In terms of the data and the release of that data, and as it fits in with kind of your existing license, exploration license, and changing licenses to leases schedule, what's an appropriate time frame?
To the chair, that's a good question. The interesting part is, in a license, a single group has exclusivity for 10 years. Having that data made available before then is really of no value to anybody unless, for the securing of those credits, they agree that the license term be shortened. For example, if the statute reads that for being eligible for the credit, seismic data, for example, is released to the public in 4 years, then the license term should also probably be truncated at some point along those lines. For the reason being is people would want to be able to use that data to encourage more exploration. Now, if the license is truncated, then there needs to be an immediate move toward leasing of that area for the protection of the party that went out and did some of the work and has, got the leg up. So I think there needs to be some sort of strike of balance between releasing the data, ensuring that the companies or the individuals who have taken somewhat of their own risk are also balanced with their ability to retain rights to do more exploration during the leasing program.
So is what you're saying then that, say, we give them 4 years for an exploration license, they should have basically first rights on leases before the expiration and before the data is made public?
Yes, sir. That would be one way to look at it.
Okay. Representative Seaton?
Thank you. Thank you. The testimony we had the other day was that since they had a license, they didn't mind releasing the data early because they have a license, so they're other than knowledge of the basin and other people to as the state as well to be able to project other areas in general knowledge. It didn't hurt them at all to release that data early. Do you have a different position?
Through the chair, not necessarily, Representative Seaton. That party that made that claim might have that opinion, and I can't say that they do or they don't. Obviously, they testify that they do. Another party might have an issue with it. I don't have a counter opinion. It intuitively, if they have a 10-year license, and then that license is then rolled to a lease, at which time they have another 10 years. Releasing the data, in fact, probably does no harm. So, but the question is if there's areas within that general area where, say, the seismic data is secured, somebody else might, in fact, see something different and unique from their interpretation that the other company did not see or understand. So there's a balance here in terms of when the data is made public and then the unintended consequences and effect of the player that showed up first.
And I guess what I was trying to do was figure out the if we're heavily investing in that project, then what we're wanting to do is get development so it helps development that's outside of their leased area. Whatever license area, and if they want to apply for those credits, it seems that that's a choice they can make to apply to the state for the credit or not.
Through the chair, I would agree that that would be their choice.
Okay.
Yeah. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the chairman had mentioned, we're also looking at the possibility of whether or not a template could be set up so that this could be applied to other basins throughout the state in addition to Nenana. There's been some interest in including credits for the Kotzebue Basin and Norton Sound Basin. And when I spoke to Bob Swenson last week with the Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, I asked him about any onshore inland natural gas sources. He said nothing is there significant enough for even local use. And so that would mean that we would need to look to offshore. Two questions. Offshore federal waters, that's considered how far out? Is it 2 miles, 3 miles?
Through the chair, it's 3 miles.
3 miles, okay, thank you.
And state waters is up to 3 miles.
Okay. And then the second question is, can you expand? You touched on it's a different ball game once you look to the federal side. And while you're not, you know, on the federal side, I just wonder if you can expand maybe a little more on that in terms of what the options might be to encourage any exploration in federal waters.
Through the chair, the federal OCS program is a program all to its own, and I would have to take some real hard time to think about how state credits would be involved in a federal program where we have no royalty. You know, we just don't have the same mechanisms of return on our investment in a federal program like we do in state programs. So I would have to beg off and give that some ponderous thought.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Do you think the approach of going at legislation one basin at a time is the best approach, or do you think we should have a more inclusive or a more expansive look, rather, at all of the basins, and that a bill like this should be a template for those developments or potential developments?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, that, again, I'm going to have to ponder for just a moment as I think about how to answer that. The conundrum is, having a template is a good idea, but trying to establish where you would target those in specific areas might actually be a deferral of the activity. So rather than trying to establish today, even though we probably have some reasonably good ideas, Director Swenson and my resource eval manager, Paul Decker, and their teams, have reasonably good ideas and can kind of guide the state in terms of where those areas should be, having it at a step at a time might actually encourage the exploration rather than delay it, whereas delayed because we have to sit there and think about too much. So areas that are known might be included early, and then as we learn more, we could add programs later.
You know, say we incentivize a seismic job, and they find stuff that looks promising, so they sink some exploratory wells. And then they sink one, and then they sink another one to delineate a find. So now we've found something that's potentially developable, and they go through the process of building the wells and the facilities and the transport mechanism to get whatever product they find to a market to sell. So at that point, you know, they're making money. Up to this point, the state has invested in the way of essentially subsidization, probably a significant dollar amount. Is it reasonable to, on the state's part, to say, you know, listen, once production starts, you are obligated, if you have taken our credits, to pay back a certain amount of that until basically our investment is paid off? Would that be seen as an incentive or a severe disincentive?
To the chair, that is very typical of what is in the Cook Inlet sale, mm-hmm. is that payback is a requirement. I don't know that I would make any adjustments. I mean, in philosophy, that what you're trying to do is reasonable. Just as the current Cook Inlet bill is reasonable in asking for that return back.
In the other, in addition, you know, the paragraph that refers specifically to the Cook Inlet incentives for jackup rig, that was part of that. But are there other payback requirements in the other parts of that that particular body of law?
To the chair, not that I recall, but I would defer to our tax group to be more clear in the response.
Okay. Is that something Paul Decker can answer? Or?
No, actually, the Department of Revenue would be the contact point here.
I think we'll probably have to bring those guys in at some point as well. Any other questions for Mr. Behrens? Representative Seaton.
We were talking about the predetermination, pre-eligibility. Can you ask?
Pre-qualification?
Yeah. Can he explain his thoughts on that?
One of the things we've the co-chairs have discussed, any of these projects is essentially broken into phases. You have the data collection phase, you have the exploratory well phase, then you move into production and eventual commercialization. Prerequisite for receiving the state subsidy, we feel it's appropriate in between each of these phases for the Department of Natural Resources and all its divisions to have some say as more of a check and a balance on just rash commercialization utilizing our money. Do you feel that's something that the department can handle? Is there the expertise to do that? Is that something we need to contract out? And is that an appropriate mechanism in your view?
To the chair, right now I won't necessarily address the manpower requirements or whether we do it in-house or contract it out. Suffice to say, having that pre-qualification meeting and setting the standards of location and direction and goals and objectives is, I think, very critical in this process. I think it's very important for the state, if the state's going to be issuing these credits, that we have that discussion up front and early and everybody agree with what the targets are.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much, Mr. Behrens. Appreciate your time. Let's see. On Friday, let's see. No. At this point, we will meet again at on Monday, February 6th. We'll be dealing with House Bill 9, which is an in-state gas line development corp bill. We'll meet here at 1 o'clock. With that, House Resources Committee will gavel out. Enjoy your weekend.